Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. We made it through May. It is June 1st, and I have to say that one of the first things I saw this morning when I went online was a picture of the White House completely dark, and I will be honest with you, I thought it was possibly Photoshop because the symbolism of that was just too stark. And so how appropriate today that we would be rejoined by David Frum, whose new book is out, Trumpocalypse. So first of all, good morning, David.
Good morning.
So crazy good luck and bad luck here is that you have the title Trumpocalypse. The bad news being, of course, that, and which makes it, the good news is that it's timely. The bad news is that we are in the middle of what feels like the apocalypse.
Abraham Lincoln used to tell a joke about a man who was tarred, feathered, and ridden out of town on a rail. And he was asked later about the experience. And according to Lincoln, he replied, "If it weren't for the honor of the thing, I'd rather have walked." And in the same way, you could feel, you know what, on the whole, I'd have rather skipped it, not had the pandemic, not had the swiftest economic collapse since 1931, not had race riots sweep the country. But there we are, and here the book is.
Well, are we at the three horsemen, three and a half horsemen? What's the fourth horseman?
Don't jinx it. We're going to find out. A meteor heading straight to Earth. Your reference to the four horsemen, though, points out something important that I'd like to say about the title. You know, in everyday speech, we use the word apocalypse to mean some catastrophe, zombie apocalypse, murder hornet apocalypse. But literally, the word apocalypse means an unveiling, to lift off a garment, a revelation. The apocalyptic literature is not literature about the end of the world. It is literature of prophecy. Now, the thing they were prophesying happened to be the end of the world, but as a prelude to the construction of a new world. So apocalypse really means knowledge, for vision. And so that's what I've tried to offer in the book is a vision of what could come after the agonies that the country is now going through.
Well, that's a positive spin on apocalypse. Of course, the collateral damage is the end of the world.
Right. But the building of a new heaven and a new earth. So that in that metaphor, I mean, we don't mean that literally. The Jews and Christians of 2,000 years ago did mean it literally. But what we can see are some important new possibilities for America.
So let's just talk about where we're at right now, because the images from around the country, I don't recall anything like this since the 1960s. And it does have that flashback, you know, the burning, the looting, the finger pointing. I mean, there's a moment of ugliness, and it's hard to know where do you start here. You know, who is doing most of the violence? How are the police responding? What's the role of Antifa? All of this sort of thing. So, just give me your thoughts on watching all of these simultaneous explosions of outrage, and then also criminality. I mean, there's the moments of real grace out there, and then there's moments of just pure hooliganism, to use an old word.
Well, I think it's always important to bear in mind that the instincts of the people around you are not so different from your own, and that most people see the world in ways that are pretty familiar to each other. So I think the things that look great, like grace notes to you, they look like grace notes to everybody. And the thing that looks like hooliganism and criminality to you, looks like that to everybody. And the moments where police seem to be, to have lost their control and their discipline, everyone sees that. And the moments where police are struggling with all their imperfections to deal with difficult situations and are maybe failing, but not failing for bad reasons, those people see that too. And we live in a media context that more than ever prioritizes and emphasizes and draws attention to, you know, the biggest loudmouths and the most instantaneous and radical perceptions. I don't think that's where most people are. I mean, the discussion on Twitter, I think it's helpful to sort of look on a night like last night, look at the images and videos captured by reputable sources, people who cover the city for Reuters and the Washington Post and other places, but don't pay too much attention to the comment, because it gives you a false idea of how people react. Most people react in the way that most people react. And so I think, you know, I would guess that there's a pretty strong consensus in the country for, you know, what happened to George Floyd was a crime, needs to be investigated and punished. And anybody who gave it permission needs to be held to account. It represents a larger national trauma, and action needs to be taken. It's also true, the country has made enormous progress on professionalizing police. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Most police officers are doing a tough job in the best way they can. In a country where they have to be, this will be one of my hobby horses, in a country where, because the country is so crazily overarmed, the police then become twitchy and too quick to react. I mean, this is one, you know, I spend much of my time in Canada. Canadian police are generally more polite than American police and generally more forbearing, but that's because they don't have to worry that there's a pistol in the glove compartment of every car. American police do have to worry about that. They also want to go home at night. Protest is the American way. Walking into the Cheesecake Factory and helping yourself to the cheesecake, that's a crime.
Yeah, that is quite an image there. So let's talk about the role of the president. Philip Rucker in the Washington Post has a really, stark lead. I'm sure you've seen this. In the 1,227 days of Trump's presidency has the nation seemed to cry out for leadership as it did Sunday, yet Trump made no attempt to provide it. That was by design. Trump and some of his advisors calculated he should not speak to the nation because he had nothing new to say, had no tangible policy or action to announce yet, etc. Frankly, I'm glad he didn't speak to the nation because I wrote today in my newsletter, this is a speech that America doesn't need to hear because we don't need the words because we know the man.
Yeah. There has been this line of Trump commentary. It's fading out now from early on, which would say, why doesn't the president, and then, suit up and play goaltender for the Washington Capitals? And the answer is because he can't skate. It would be absurd to ask him to suit up and play goaltender for the Washington Capitals. He can't do that. It might be funny for a second or two, but it would ultimately only lead to disaster for all involved. And in the same way, they're just things he can't do. And I completely agree with you. I think there actually is a small act of self-knowledge in the president not speaking. And there's also the beginning. I shouldn't say not the beginning. This has been going on for some while, but there is the next step in his progressive resignation from the presidency. This is a very demanding job. He can't do it. He understands he can't do it, and he stopped doing it.
And yet, he very much wants to now make this into 1968 again. And he actually was talking to gave a statement to the New York Times where he says he thinks he's going to be reelected, and he's going to be reelected easily. He's going to turn the economy around. It's going to make America great. And if that doesn't work, basically he has the super caravan. Are the people. I alone can stand in the breach and stop these marauding hordes, Antifa in the central cities, otherwise who will destroy this country, law and order. And that both instinctually and tactically, that's going to be appealing to him. So I guess the question is, do you think that works? Will that work?
I think that there are many reasons that it's bad to be historically illiterate. And among them is that when you start looking for historical analogies, you don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I was 8 years old in 1968, so I have only faint memories of it, but I do have faint memories of it. I was living in Canada. I was a boy. We saw it across the bridge, the disorder. People do not remember how Richard Nixon won that election. He did not win it as a candidate of racial backlash. Many of his detractors would say so. And after the catastrophe of Watergate and the failure of his presidency, the detractors got a louder voice. But the Richard Nixon of 1968, the most important thing to remember about 1968 was that it was a three-way race.
George Wallace.
Humphrey, Nixon, and George Wallace. Nixon ran as the candidate of the middle way. Tougher and more responsible than the illusioned Hubert Humphrey, but adamantly against the segregationism and backlash of George Wallace. I was just writing something about this today, so let me pull up a couple of things that I unearthed. First, I think these lines from Richard Nixon's acceptance speech in August of 1968 give you the perfect sense of the tone Nixon was striving for. He said, there's three lines. And to those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is a reply. Our goal is justice for every American. If we are to have respect for law in America, we must have laws that deserve respect. Just as we cannot have progress without order, we cannot have order without progress. And so as we commit to order tonight, let us commit to progress. Mm-hmm. So he was running as a candidate who, unlike his immediate predecessors, Republican nominee Barry Goldwater, who accepted the civil rights laws and who wanted to consolidate them. Remember, the Republican Party had nominated Nixon in 60. By renominating him in 68, they were saying, "Ah, forget about that Goldwater lunatic. Right. That back to business as usual.
Yes, return to normalcy."
And the last thing that needs, I was just watching just before you and I spoke, Richard Nixon's TV ad from 1968 called Law and Order. Mm-hmm. And it's a strikingly modern piece of video making. Fast cuts, discordant music, very, very upsetting. There's not a single black face in the ad. And the ad also, it's an ad about student radicalism. And it is an ad attacking the Chicago police, Mayor Daley's police. Mm. Because what you see in the ad, about half the young faces you see are unkempt and carrying radical slogans and screaming and looking aggressive. But about half of them are, people with shorter hair who look perfectly peaceful, who are bleeding. And then you cut to images of fat-faced police in ridiculous riot gear and firing tear gas. That the law and order is as much an attack, because what he's saying is the Democratic Party is not, he's attacking them not just for being the party of radicalism. Remember, Lyndon Johnson is still president. They're not that radical a party. But also, they're the party of Mayor Daley. So, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Liberal Republican in Illinois, Mr. and Mrs. Chuck Percy Republican, your son or daughter went to protest in Chicago and was perfectly law-abiding, and they got hit in the head by one of Mayor Daley's cops. May I remind you, sir, madam, that Mayor Daley is a Democrat, vote Nixon. That was part of the message too. And although I'm sure it resonated with segregation South, it's also worth remembering in 1968, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Arkansas voted for Wallace, not Nixon. Wallace had won 5 states in the Electoral College in 68.
You know, by the way, I was in Chicago in 1968 for that convention.
Wow. So, what were you doing there?
I was a little footnote here, a little digression. I was actually out there during the police riot, and I won't say I was tear gassed, but I was close enough to now I can smell and know what tear gas feels like. I was, I think I was 12 or 13 years old, and I was a page to the Wisconsin delegation to the convention. Yeah. So I actually had floor privileges. I was there. Because my father had been the campaign manager for Eugene McCarthy. And I will tell you that in 1968, it did feel like everything was coming apart. I mean, for people who want to compare 1968 to 2020, remember we had had the assassination of Martin Luther King and the riots earlier in the year. We had had the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And then, of course, what happened in Chicago. And but let me just pull back a little bit for how Trump might exploit all of this, because there, after the urban riots of the 60s, that really did lead to the sorting out, the white flight, the divisions of blue and red. You had an entire cadre of white voters who I think were shaped by this. And, you know, in many ways, this was the predicate for Donald Trump. And he sees this as an opportunity to, fire up that sort of division for his benefit. And I'm not sure that won't work, at least with his base. The question is whether it will work with the electorate as a whole.
So let me address the two things. So first, on the specific question of does it help Trump? Trump is not Richard Nixon in 1968. He is Mayor Daley. In 1968,
okay,
it's Mayor Daley plus George Wallace. He's the guy who did it. He's not the guy who has the answer. He's the culprit, and he's the guy we have to replace if we want to get to a place of peace. To your second point about the larger cultural implications about how the disorder of 1968 sent the country in a more conservative direction, I think that's true. I wrote a whole book about it, called A History of the 1970s. But that kind of history with multi-causes does not repeat itself, because we're a different country, including, most importantly, for the reason you just so correctly identified a minute ago, we're a much more peaceful country than we were in the 1960s. We, I think, are less scared than, I mean, 68 was way, and I think we both remember, 68 was way scarier than this. This is shameful. This is upsetting. This is disturbing. But it's also noteworthy, the violence that we've seen over the past 3 days is overwhelmingly symbolic violence. I pray I'm not wrong on this, that there has been one person in 3 days of violence, one fatality in Detroit, a young man killed by persons unknown. In 68, I mean, there were assassinations. There were hundreds of dead. I mean, the urban, each of the urban riots would leave behind, you know, there'd be 50 or 60 in Watts, 50 or 60 in Detroit. The police were way less competent and professional, and the rioters were.
No, and there were thousands of Americans who were dying in Vietnam as well. I mean, that whole thing, we were in the middle of that war. So there were several layers that we don't have at the moment.
Right. And I think a lot of people are looking at this and thinking, and we also are struck by how many of the protesters are reasonable people making reasonable demands. Please, when you make an arrest, do not choke the suspect to death. especially when it turns out the suspect has done nothing wrong. Please, you know, kindly refrain from doing that in the future. And if a cop does do that, please swiftly bring the cop to justice. I think we are all getting, we can all see the difference between the people exercising their rights to assembly for public safety and the people who are looting the Cheesecake Factory.
Let's talk about the role of white radicals here, because Trump, to the extent that he actually has a tactic here, he seems to be focusing on Antifa. He's going out of his way not to make this into a racial thing, at least so far. I mean, obviously, that's part of the message. But again, he's drumming away that they are these outside agitators. These are the masked white, protesters who are somehow hijacking this protest. And there's certainly a subtext of this going on, isn't there? I mean, some of the most compelling videos are watching the leaders of the protest protecting stores from looks like white suburban cosplaying radicals, or one of the leaders of the demonstration, a black woman who's yelling at two white protesters who are spray painting a building, saying, "We're going to get blamed for this." So yeah. how do we sort this out? Because there is a layer of complexity here.
Well, the question that we are, I think, going to be discussing, one of the questions we're discussing is Antifa an organization?
No, not really.
As the president said in a tweet, yeah. Or is it a slogan and a style and a fashion? And I'll tell you, one of the clips I saw that made an impression on me was three, I think actually this was from your Wisconsin, three white teenagers, probably about 17 boys, on a curb surrounded by angry black adults. And what you learned from the thing was the boys had been attempting to loot a liquor store in Milwaukee. And they weren't Antifa. They were just three 17-year-old boys who had been locked up 4 weeks and cut off from their usual supply of illegal beer, and who saw in the disorder an opportunity to sneak out of the house and help themselves to illegal beer. And they had no political, obviously, they had no political agenda. They were just bored troublemakers. And I don't say that in a condemnatory way, because who has not been a 17-year-old boy? Well, half the population has not been a 17-year-old boy. But among the half of the population that has been a 17-year-old boy, you know what we're like, right? Somebody has to sit on us and make us human beings. So there they were. And I think a lot of the people, when you have a commotion like this, how many black bloc anarchists are there in the United States?
Yeah.
200? 300? How many bored teenagers are there who think it's fun to see things burn and enjoy breaking a window if no one's looking? Tens of thousands, I assume.
Yes.
Right? So these things become opportunities for boys like those three boys we saw in Wisconsin to try to loot a liquor store. And if they're not caught, they will. And in the next morning, no one will know the difference between, you know, whether it was they or career criminals or Antifa or who robbed that store. They got caught, so we know.
How much of a risk is there for Democrats who, at least initially, some of the progressives were initially reluctant, it appeared, to condemn the looting and the criminality? Josh Krashauer had a great piece in National Journal and said, hey, guys, understand this is an area of vulnerability. You know, if America begins to think that progressives are all like the feckless mayor of Minneapolis, you have a problem.
Yeah. Well, this is why I think the Democrats got lucky with their nominee. There are certainly Democrats who would have bungled this moment. If somehow Beto O'Rourke had won, you can just imagine him making a national pratfall. But they found a guy who's just too old to be woke. When the president calls him Sleepy Joe, I mean, he's not exactly sleepy, but it is true that he's not woke. And he's at least, you know, two-thirds non-sleepy. So I just don't think you're going to convince anybody that, the Biden ticket, that the Biden, it looks very Nixonian. It looks like, you know, most of the people who voted for Nixon didn't want to roll back the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Act. They didn't want to see police riots. They didn't like Mayor Daley. They just wanted decency and calm. And they wanted to consolidate the gains of the civil rights era in a peaceful way and see the growth of a black middle class. I think that's and Nixon said, I'm for that. You know, and I'll definitely keep things quiet. And I'm also going to, you know, put a cord around the neck of Mayor Daley. He's not going to do that anymore.
See, this is interesting. You're right about this, but it's going to feel like revisionist history to think about calm and decency, Richard Nixon. I mean, because in retrospect, we don't think of him that way.
That's not who he was. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's that. We have the tapes. We can hear his, you know, inner self, which was cruel and bigoted and anti-Semitic and racist. But Nixon had a presented self, which is all that was available to people in 1968.
You wrote a piece a couple of days ago. Trump is the looter. The president is exposing problems in America that most did not want to see. Talk to me about that.
Well, it's just kind of outrageous, isn't it, for Donald Trump to talk about law and order. Here's a guy who has been accused by America's leading newspaper of tax fraud in so many words, outside the statute of limitations, but still, it's a crime. ProPublica, however you like to pronounce it, which is a very careful reporting source, has amassed a great array of documentation that strongly point to the possibility that that Trump underreported rents to New York state tax authorities, suggesting that he was guilty either of state tax fraud or maybe bank fraud, because maybe he reported the truth to the tax authorities and lied to his lenders because they got the bank documents, or both. There's just law breaking after law breaking. They looted his inauguration committee. They looted his the family charity. He got much more out of those. He got much more out of his inaugural committee than you're going to get out of 100 Cheesecake Factories. So he has no standing on this issue.
No, unless you see law and order strictly in terms of, you know, black people breaking windows or something like that. So let me talk a little bit about. I'm sorry. We're taking a somewhat more optimistic point of view of, you know, comparing us to 1968. And I agree, by the way, that 1968 was far more violent, far more deadly, until we have, you know, two or three major political figures who were assassinated. We're not in that league. On the other hand, I have to tell you that it feels like we spent 3 years warning about, you know, things falling apart and how bad things can get. And it feels like everything is coming together right now. It feels to me as if we are moments away from the potential of real escalation of violence in a way that we haven't seen. The way in which the glamorization of, you know, people, you know, with guns, you know, versus protesters, and the president. Antifa, I think, are a bunch of thugs. But when the president says we're going to designate them a terrorist organization, they're not really an organization. But what do you do with terrorists? You kill terrorists. So, I mean, the potential for actual violence, I think, is, in, especially as we're going into the summer, I have to say that this is as scary a moment as I can remember since 1968.
Well, it's not potential violence. We have a real armed terrorist movement at work, and it is a global white nationalist movement that is, it's not pro-Trump in the sense they accept him as a leader, as the man who, I'm now going to forget which of, oh, the man who carried out the attack on the synagogue, I think, said. Mm-hmm. But no, it was the man who carried out the attack on the mosque in New Zealand who killed 50 people. He was asked, he wasn't asked, he put together a manifesto and he asked himself what he thought of Donald Trump. And he said, as a leader, good God, no. As a symbol, yes. So that we are dealing with a global movement of violent insurrection, highly networked. That is, these are individuals. They communicate through, and they don't know each other personally. There's no central command. They don't share weapons or training or anything like that. But they do share ideology. And I have a chapter in Trumpocalypse about the rise of this group. And although we often call them white nationalists, there's nothing nationalist about it because they actually have much more. It is a truly global movement. So I don't make light of any of the difficulties. And of course, nearly 40 million people are out of work. And of course, we have this pandemic, which may have just gotten a lot worse because of the interchanges that people had over the past 3 days of strife. But here, the difference, and this is the thing that motivated me to write the book, the difference between now and 68 was, in 68, it was very hard to see what the answers were. How did you get out of Vietnam in an honorable way? Mm-hmm. How did you bring restore hope to cities that had been centers of manufacturing a decade before and that now seemed just hopeless? Bobby Kennedy in 68 had a project called the Bed-Stuy Project, mm-hmm. Bedford-Stuyvesant Project, and because after this depressed area of Brooklyn, and his plan was to try to find ways to bring factories to Bedford-Stuyvesant. And if you said, no, Bobby, the solution is it's going to be full of stores that sell machines that contain all the world's knowledge in your pocket. And music studios and, hipsters paying, $11 for a frothed cup of soy. What? That's an economic plan? Believe me, it'll work. that we can see. And that's the thing that is so maddening about the Trump years. We can see, and I struggle with this. You can see the answers. You can see how we could put this country onto a path of stable economic growth. You can see how we can one of the things that I take from this pandemic, we closed down half the economy of the country. We sent people home, and we just stopped productive activity. And at any 50 years ago, if we'd done that, people would have literally starved to death.
Yeah.
30 years ago, if we'd done that, we would have, we can afford it. We can afford to do that. I mean, that just gives you a sense of the extraordinary wealth of capital and knowledge and connectivity in a modern economy. What we could do, what we just demonstrated with this pandemic is what we could do. So supposing when this is behind us, that we can take that energy and instead of using it, that wealth, instead of using it to pay for idleness, use it to pay for activity. What we could do. One of the things I talk a lot about in the book in Trumpocalypse is the climate problem, which I regard not, I mean, there's so much climate gloom. I just regard it as such an area of possibility, what could be achieved, how the wealth we are going to produce while solving the problem. I just see possibility after possibility. And I that's, to me, very unlike the world of 1970.
It does, the optimism. But so how does the coronavirus affect us? I'm a little bit puzzled right now because right now it feels like America's just done with it. Like it's not, it didn't happen. It's not a big deal anymore. We're not even commenting on the lack of social distancing in the protests, which, by the way, is being noticed. The commentators who kept emphasizing that, well, we had these protests in Michigan and they're not social distancing. We're not even seeing that with all of this. If there is a big resurgence of this virus later this year, what does that do? How does that change us? I think you make the case that this is going to change the debate about healthcare and about a variety of other things. We are going to have a stronger health system. But how else does that change us?
Well, one of the things I desperately hope it does is it makes us realize it's just crazy that in America your healthcare is tied to your job. Mm. It's just dumb. This has been the thing that has led me into various deviations from Republican orthodoxy over the past decade. And I started this because I would see friends who worked for big companies who had ideas that would make a maybe make a good company of their own. In one case, a friend, but he had a disabled kid. And if he started his own company, what would happen to his kid's healthcare provision? So he never did. Now, maybe the idea wouldn't have worked. Maybe it would have been just a nice little business. Maybe it was, you know, the yeah. next Zoom. Who knows what we lost because he didn't dare quit his job. But wouldn't it be good if he could have, if he could try? And isn't the way to make him try to ensure, you know, your kid, you go start that company, it'll succeed, it'll fail. But whatever happens, your kid will continue to see your kid's doctors. Don't worry. You don't have to worry about that. You're going to have enough worries with that new business without having to worry, does my child lose the healthcare for my child's conditions? And we're going to see this now. How long is it going to take us to put all those 40 million people back to work? 2-3 years, if we're lucky?
If we're lucky.
So what happened? Like, and because of a disease, they lose their healthcare? How does that make sense?
Well, you know, I'm thinking back on the first time that you and I ever spoke, and I think it was when I was doing a show for WNYC, and you had just, the Trump administration had just begun, and you had a big piece in The Atlantic about the danger of authoritarianism. It had a catchy title. Do you remember what it was?
How to Build an Autocracy.
How to Build an Autocracy. And it felt like after a while, that was very real. And then, of course, the cool kids decided that these warnings were overblown, that the Trump was really not that autocratic, that he wasn't competent enough, that he wasn't focused. I would say that within the last week, and the problem is that everything happens so fast, you're seeing a tendency on the part of Trump, with the active support of many people on the right, for a much more overtly autocratic form of government, particularly when it comes to media, social media, a variety of those things. And so I wonder whether or not we are also seeing the possibility. I mean, you know, maybe this optimistic scenario you're laying out will play out, but also the real a challenge to democratic norms that feels much more real right now. It is played out in your darkest view from 2017, if you follow me.
Yeah, but I think that article, I recommend it to people. Parts of it show up in a book I wrote in 2018 called Trumpocracy, which not many of the ideas from the 2017 article got expanded. But look, when Trump immediately won, there was a lot of loose talk. And I remember I said before about how damaging historical illiteracy is. One of the other penalties of historical illiteracy is that if you don't know much history, the only history you know is the Third Reich. And so you compare everything to that.
Yes, exactly.
And the problem is nothing is like that. It's such an extreme scenario produced by such extreme circumstances that it was so obviously a bad idea. Your cities get reduced to rubble. I mean, no one's going to do that again. So I've tried to be realistic and very specific about what I mean, what the dangers are. And one of the most important sentences in that 2017 article, and I repeated in the 2018 book, and I heard it on a reporting trip I did to Hungary in 2016, is we're dealing with modern bureaucratic states. We're not dealing with societies on the brink of civil war, as Germany was before Hitler took over. These are modern bureaucratic states. And in a modern bureaucratic state, the benefit of lawless power is not the ability to persecute the innocent. That's just too difficult. It's the ability to protect the guilty. And that has been the theme of the Trump years. Yeah, it's not, I mean, obviously he's not rounding up you and me and hauling us off to detention camps. And I've always really set my face against people who use the language of resistance. I have this, again, a joke I've been using since 2017. If you're not in danger of being tortured if captured, you don't belong to a resistance. you're the political opposition. But what he has done, and you see this more and more, is absolutely power is wielded to protect the guilty. So if you're an insider trader in the Senate and you're friendly with the president, you get protected. If you're an insider trader and you're not friendly with the president, you get the law. If you lie to the FBI and you're friendly with the president, your case gets taken care of. If you lie to the FBI and you're not, you get the law. So that it isn't that Trump he's tried at various points, or he's talked about sicking the law on his opponents, and he's always gotten nowhere with that. But one of the other things that's true in a modern bureaucratic state is most wealthy and prominent people, there is a law that you could argue they've broken. Mm-hmm. And you just have to find it. And that, whether it's insider trading in the Senate, whether it's untrue statements to an investigative authority, you can find it. And then if you have the power to protect or not to protect, that becomes just as good as the power to accuse people falsely.
So in your book, you use the phrase fascioid, that yeah. Trump is internationally part of this fascioid movement, which is it a diluted form of fascism? Is it fascist-like, fascist-light?
Well, here I'm talking less about Donald Trump and Trump's immediate political entourage personally, than I'm talking about the movement that Steve Bannon has been trying to build. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about what's going on in India with this return, this Hindu chauvinism. I'm talking about, Viktor Orban. And the OID, fascioid is kind of a clunky coinage, I admit that. But what I'm trying to strive for is, if you remember your high school science, if you had a chemical that was like an alkaline but wasn't actually an alkaline, you'd call it an alkaloid. And if you saw in the sky an object that was like a planet but wasn't one, you called it a planetoid. Right. Oid means, in science, it means similar to, but not the same, or having sharing characteristics with. And so
I don't think this is clunky, by the way. I actually think this is very descriptive. I actually found that to be
thank you.
I found it to be useful, but go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because the fascist movements of the 20s and 30s, they were the work of people who had witnessed or lived through or fought in the First World War. If you were a German in 1935 or 1933 and you saw a dead body in the street, obviously a dead body didn't belong in the street, but you'd seen lots of dead bodies. It was not in itself shocking to you. If you were to see a dead body in the street today, you would think, my God, I mean, it's the world's ending. So they were used to a level of violence that we can't accept. And they also lived in a world that was much younger. I mean, fascism had this whole method of youth and virility. We are a movement against the old men, the old liberals. Well, whatever you say about Trumpism, it ain't a movement of the young. So it's got important differences. And fascism also was geared toward aggression, and literal military aggression, but also very high levels of real world aggression, rather than the kind of symbolic performative aggression that you see from modern people. Now, it's different in India. It's different in some emerging democracies or less developed countries. Well, it's not the same as the 30s.
No. See, and then that's the, it's important to make those distinctions. But the sort of the valorization of strength and force and the performative nature of that among some of the in Trump world, it at least has those echoes, and I think I saw one tweet that was retweeted by Buck Sexton, who tweeted that the only way it will end is if the good guys use like maximum force against the bad guys. And the president retweeted that. And it's just sort of like the, I am the man of strength who alone can protect you and will do it by using the most vicious force we can. I mean, there's almost this quasi-adolescent sexual exultation in the use of excessive force with the vicious dogs. And that's a little fascioid.
Yes, right. And look, one of the great anti-fascist artistic expressions in the United States is the Western movie, which is about not about the man of strength, but the man who has the courage of right. I mean, the High Noon story, where mm-hmm. one person willing to do the right thing stands up against the mob. That is also that there's something that goes very much against the American grain in the way Trump is a bully who speaks the language of bullying, and there's a kind of operatic quality to it that is self-sabotaging. But yes, there we have this. And look, we have a lot of frightened people in this country. And God knows they don't have much reason to be frightened, but they are. And they subscribe to entertainment and information services that exist by making them frightened. Mm-hmm. And you know, I had for many years, he's now dead. I had a relative who worked on the Israeli nuclear weapons program in an important capacity. And then he retired and he became just so many of the people from the like most lethal edge of the Israeli Defense Services are, he became an ultra dove and an ultra liberal.
Really? Yeah.
And I remember him once saying to me, I wish I could tell the people of Israel just how safe they are. I devoted my life to this. I wish they could know how safe they are. And that's a message. I mean, America is so rich. It's so strong. The resources of the state are so enormous. Of course you can be protected. You do not need some blowhard. You do not need your own AR-15. You know, you're safe. Be generous.
So let me ask you one last question. I, you know, somebody tweeted out over the weekend that remember when, are you old enough to remember when we thought that the 2020 election would turn on the question of impeachment? And now nobody remembers impeachment. And then you might remember this too. Then people thought that the election was going to turn on the coronavirus and the economy. And now it's, you know, how are we going to deal with police violence and in the urban unrest? There's a real possibility that by November, all of those things will be very far in the rearview mirror, given our both amnesia and our very, very short attention span. So, David Frum, what will 2020 be about, the election be about? What will be this? I mean, we will look back on this. And it will be about what? It's not going to be about impeachment. It may not be about the coronavirus. It may not be about the economy, stupid. But what will it be about?
I think it will be about putting people back to work, about recovery, and the kind of country you build coming out of the recovery. Because remember, elections are decided not by the people who listen to podcasts like this one, with all God bless each and every one of you. And thank you for your civic commitment. But elections are decided by people who are more lightly attached to the political process who have very heavy personal concerns. And they are going to be worried still in November, but how do they get back to work and what do they find when they get there and how do they remain physically safe? And it remains a very moderate country. They want to be told both that if things go wrong, there's some kind of protection for them, and that if things go well, they're going to be able to keep the proceeds of their success and pass it on to their children. That's what Americans are going to want. And you know, these protests, you know, I'm sure, unlike the 60s, unlike the movements, I think you can hear in the protests very specific demands that are actually very feasible. You know, I just like to be treated with respect. I'd like not to be afraid of the police, and I'd like to have my chance to get a piece of the American action.
Will part of it just also be the kind of had enough? Have you just had enough of this? Do you want to return to some sort of a normal life that not so much, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, but can you take 4 more years of this?
Yeah. You mean like, damn right I'm Sleepy Joe, and after 4 years of me, you're going to be sleeping too.
By the way, I am all in on that. I would crawl through broken glass to be bored over the next 4 years.
I have a heavy personal investment in this because, I had a big personal writing project on a historical subject that I wanted to do starting in 2017. And if Hillary Clinton had won that election, I had this fantasy of, you know, I'm really going to step back from political punditry. I've said what I've had to say, and I want to work on these other things. And I want to try some new forms. I want to experiment with video rather than text. There are things I wanted to do. And now I've 4 years of super intense political commitment, writing 2 and 3 times a week, 2 books in 3.5 years. I really want to get to my project. And that's something that is important, not to the world, but to me. And I want to, you know, do different things. And I mean, my youngest child is about to go off to college, and you know, we want to enjoy a different phase of our lives. I just need this guy gone.
David, I cannot begin to articulate how much I am exactly where you're at. This feeling, I just need this to be over so that we can go on to something different.
Yes.
And I wonder whether or not, I mean, obviously we have unique professional engagements with this, but I just have this gut sense that many, many Americans are going to feel that way by the end of this campaign. Just make it stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me go on with my life.
Exactly. David Frum, the book is Trumpocalypse. It is an absolute must read, as was Trumpocracy as well. I mean, these are going to be historical artifacts. So, David Frum, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast.
Always so glad to be here. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.